total of six cases. Two of them are being submitted without oral argument today on the briefs. They are appeal number 06-3315, Kerr v. Department of the Army, and appeal number 06-1556, Grasky v. Patent and Trademark Office. The argument this morning will first hear appeal number 05-1587, RFI Industries v. Rexhide Industries. Mr. Oat, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
Please proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Robert Oak, and I represent RFR Industries. This is an appeal of two summary judgments of a bench trial, two attorney fee awards, and a permanent injunction. The district court initially granted a summary judgment against RFR and in favor of Century on the issue of indemnity. Then a bench trial was held solely on the issue of indemnity between Century and Rexhide. Following this bench trial, the district court found that indemnity existed, and based on that finding, held that RFR's patent infringement claims against Rexhide had been extinguished or released through the circuity of indemnity that the district court held had occurred.
Well, counsel, what about the injunction? As I recall, the complaint prayed for injunctive relief as well as damages. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, it did.
And did the request for injunctive relief disappear at some point? Was it waived or forfeited or abandoned during the litigation?
No, Your Honor. The patent infringement issues were never reached by the district court. And so the patent infringement issues of RFR against Rexhide, whether Rexhide infringed and a permanent injunction should be entered against Rexhide, that issue was never reached.
Well, I understand, but what I'm trying to get clarity on is, even if there were what's been called circular indemnity, that might only take care of damages, but not the right of a patentee to enjoin continuing infringement of a patent.
Your Honor, I don't disagree with that. The judgment was made final under the certification procedures. And so it was felt that the patent issues should not be litigated and the contractual indemnity issues should be litigated. But I don't disagree with Your Honor about the injunctive.
Well, I accept that you don't disagree with the Chief, but I didn't see anywhere in the brief where you argued that. I mean, you didn't argue, did you, that even assuming there is a circular indemnity, there's still this potential for this need for an injunction out there to protect our rights under the patent?
Well, because that issue was never reached in the district court, at the district court level, the issue of patent infringement and whether an injunction should be entered, that simply was never reached. And my view would be that issue is still alive, particularly if this case is reversed. And I suppose even if this case is not reversed, that would.
So you're betting the ranch then on convincing us that complete circularity of indemnity was not established?
Well, I would say that I have not thought through the other issue.
Which probably means that your opponents will argue that you waived it. You didn't raise it below, you didn't raise it in your brief, too late now, therefore tell us about why the indemnity is not circular.
Okay. All the material facts on the indemnity issues and release issues are undisputed, except for one issue. And that issue is whether Century initially provided Rexhide with the design specifications. Even that disputed fact is ultimately irrelevant when the law is properly applied to the undisputed facts. I'd like to first discuss the indemnity release issues, then the attorney's fees issues, and then briefly the injunction. The district court, after the bench trial, held that Century owed Rexhide statutory and contractual indemnity. Now, the statute in play here is Texas and Business Commerce Code 2.312C, and that is similar to the UCC provision, and that contains both a warranty provision and an indemnity provision. Two district courts, in the Chemtron and Motorola case, have held that the warranty provision does not apply to conduct-based claims, such as induced infringement. And the reasoning of these courts is that the warranty extends only as to the product and not to claims involving conduct. Further reasoning in these courts is that a person should not be able to purchase a non-infringing product, then through their own conduct, create a cause of action and impose liability on the seller. This court should also hold that the indemnity provision of this statute does not apply to conduct-based claims for several reasons. First of all, under the language of the statute, the two sections, warranty and indemnity, use the same, use the term claim in an identical fashion. The indemnification provision uses the language such claim, which refers back to the phrase rightful claim of infringement or the like in the warranty provision. Since the statute uses the term claim in a consistent manner between the warranty provision and the indemnity provision, and when the warranty provision is properly construed to not include conduct-based claims, it would be consistent to also interpret the indemnification provision as not including conduct-based claims. Secondly,
what do we mean conduct-based claims?
The claims involving
manufacturing is a form of conduct.
Well, the particular issue, or the particular claim in these two cases was induced infringement, where you have to have knowledge and an intent that the part would be used in an infringing manner. Secondly, the underlying reasoning is the same. A purchaser who provides specifications for a non-infringing product should not have to indemnify a seller when the seller's own culpable, for the seller's own culpable conduct, if the seller knows that the non-infringing part will be used in an infringing manner. And this would be particularly true if the seller knew that it would be used in an infringing manner and the purchaser did not know. The official comment to this section also supports this interpretation because it states that for a duty of indemnity to arise, it must be the resulting product that infringes the patent.
And this is all under the Uniform Commercial Code. What are you talking about now?
Yes, Your Honor. Statutory indemnity. So in conclusion, there is not statutory indemnity. Now, the Rexhide and Century have mentioned the cover case decided by this court. Cover case does not apply. The specific issue and only issue there was whether the patent marking statute preempted a similar statute. And the cover case does not address this specific issue. Cover, this court ruled that the patentee had settled with everyone, and therefore the patent statute was no longer in the picture. In this case, it still is in the picture. So in conclusion, no statutory indemnity between Century and Rexhide. The second basis was contractual indemnity. The only source for contractual indemnity between Rexhide and Century was on the reverse side of a quotation form, the boilerplate language. There was absolutely no evidence of any other written agreement or oral agreement or any contemporaneous...
Are you suggesting that the fact that it's boilerplate or it was printed on the backside of a piece of paper has some legal significance?
Only to the extent that we are limited only to the contracts in play. And there's no evidence that the parties had any discussions about what terms should be included in these documents at the time. There's no evidence that the parties discussed indemnity at all during these transactions.
Well, the assertion isn't that there was an oral contract concerning indemnity based on oral discussions. The assertion is that the quotation text merged into the final sale contract and agreed term of the contract. And therefore, the language in that quotation form is language.
language of the final contract. What's your answer to that?
Well, since there was no other evidence except the exchange of the documents, the issue about whether the terms became a part of the contract must be decided solely by looking at the documents themselves. And under Texas law, a quotation form that reserves the right of acceptance in the person offering the quote is incapable as a matter of law of being an offer that can be accepted. Therefore,
the argument isn't that it became a contract immediately itself. The argument, as I understand it, is it was part of the exchange of documents that resulted undeniably, in the end, in a sale contract, rubber for money. But the term insisted on by the extruder was a term that contained indemnity language. Well, I don't understand how that gets derailed somehow.
Well, under contract law, particularly Texas contract law, you must have an offer and an acceptance.
There's no doubt in the end there was an offer and acceptance and a valid contract of sale for the rubber, for money. The only question is, what are all the terms of that contract? The argument, as I understand it, on the other side is that whether it constituted an offer by itself that could form a contract upon acceptance or not, it still became part of the contract document. It was an understood, documented part of the final sale contract. I don't understand how you're responding to that.
Okay. Well, you can have a contract that is based upon the conduct of the parties. But in that case, the terms of the
contract...
That's
not what they're arguing for. They're not saying because of some kind of conduct not recorded in text. They're saying, here's some text. It became part of the final contract. It merged into the other documents to be part of the final contract. And I don't see that you have an answer to that.
When you have documents going back and forth, you have to analyze the documents and say, where's the offer, where's the acceptance? And if the only indemnity terms are on a document that came before the initial offer, that never becomes a part of the contract.
What's your basis for saying that? I would Texas think it would always become a part of the contract.
No, because when you initially have a quote and you reserve the right of acceptance, that means something else has to be the offer. And in this case, the purchase order was the offer, and it came after
the
quotation.
Yes, but the party submitting the quote is obviously saying, I'm willing to bargain with you, the other party to this potential contract, but only on the terms set out in the text on the back of this document.
Well,
so that when there later is something that we can all agree was an offer, and still later something we can all agree as an acceptance, that term carries forward. The text carries forward.
Well, the underlying reason, the way I understand it, that a quote that reserves the right of acceptance does not become an offer, is because in contract law, an offer is something that ultimately, if it's accepted, it forms the contract. If you have a quote that reserves the right of acceptance, it cannot be accepted to form a contract. The person that offers the quote has the option of getting out of it and not living with the contract terms.
I understand your view. Do you want to save any of your rebuttal time? You're down to less than 2 minutes here.
Well, let me ask you just for a few seconds a question about this on the attorney's fees issue.
Yes.
Did you make an argument to the district court that there shouldn't be an obligation to pay attorney's fees when you determine the waiver of indemnification?
Yes, I did.
That argument was made?
Yes, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and the district court never dealt with that argument?
No, Your Honor, didn't. Let me finally say on the contractual issue that the contract quote form only covered parts produced, didn't cover conduct, so even if there is contractual indemnity, it does not cover the contract. Let me just say, if I could, on the no release clause, even if there was statutory and contractual indemnity between Century and Rexide, the contract settlement agreement between RFR and Century contemplated this. And RFR put in a clause that said, nothing in this agreement shall be construed as a release of Rexide. And I detailed in the brief why that should not result in a dip. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Hefner?
May it please the court. I represent Trekside Industries, Inc. And what's telling when I was reviewing Appellant's R. Farrell's brief is, in his entire statement of facts, although we had a bench trial, there's not one record cite to the trial evidence. Rather, all his record cites are to self-serving affidavit statements from his president. That's because he has no trial testimony or evidence to support his story. On the other hand, we have clear findings of fact from the district judge, and those findings of facts are overwhelmingly supported by the trial evidence.
Well, let me ask you about the attorney fees. Was our record as a matter of law, are they obligated to pay attorney's fees with respect to establishing indemnification? Because they make that argument in the blue brief, and you don't seem to explicitly disagree with that.
That was briefed out in front of the judge, and the judge, I think, took that into consideration when he reduced our fees by approximately 30%.
Yeah, but we're here reviewing the district. I mean, the district court judge didn't mention the issue of whether or not there's a right to attorney's fees on indemnification or not. Right. Are you assuming then, are you saying that we should assume that the 25% knockdown was to cover that portion of the fees that dealt with indemnification?
That was my assumption, Your Honor.
And how are we supposed to review them? I mean, we should just make that assumption. And is there any discussion about why 25% would do it? In terms of that,
that was not explicitly set out in his order. I assume under his discretion, he produced it according to the respondent's brief and the arguments made by all parties. Getting back to the findings of fact, the district judge found that when Rexide presented a quote, Century responded with a purchase order, a contract was formed. Mr. Oakes wants to argue that somehow there's a reservation of rights in our quotation. He sets out the first two or three sentences in our quote, but importantly, he leaves out the very next sentence, which states, the receipt of your purchase order is an acceptance of this proposal if your purchase order agrees with this proposal with respect to description of parts, price, and delivery. So it's my position there is no reservation by Rexide. It's very clear in the quote itself. Once they send the purchase order, contract is formed, the terms and conditions on the quote are part of the contract. He cites no Texas law. He cites an unpublished Ohio opinion and another opinion, Axelson, which is not on Texas law. Both those cases have nothing to do with the situation in this case. Those cases, in each of those cases, one of the parties of the contract denied the existence of the contract. Here, everybody agrees there's a contract. Everybody stipulates there's a contract. The judge found and concluded there was a contract. Furthermore, there's no battle of forms here. To have a battle of forms, you have to have conflicting language. The judge made a specific finding of fact that there's no conflicting language. As far as the statutory indemnity is concerned, there is a specific finding of fact by the judge that Century furnished the specifications and drawings. This, again, was supported by a substantial trial. That's Chris Goday, the employee for Century, testified that he made each and every drawing. He submitted as trial evidence all the drawings from 92 to 99. Lee Loper, representative of Rexide, said we could not even go to step two, which is the CAD drawing, until we had the original drawing. And we would never make a CAD drawing without the original drawing. Century, from the very inception of this lawsuit, admitted day one that they furnished the original specs and drawings in their answer. It's also stipulated. Mr. Oakes wants this court to establish new law that the hold harmless provision, indemnity, does not apply after the goods are delivered and transferred, citing the Chemtron and the Motorola cases. Both these cases are misplaced. As this court's well aware, Section 2.312C has two very distinct provisions. It has the warranty against infringement and the hold harmless. Today, we're dealing with the hold harmless. All his cases deal with the warranty against infringement provision. And he has no case law. He admits this on page 17 of his reply brief, that he has no case law dealing with this so-called conduct argument. And this is stated on page 17 of his brief. Tellingly, is in his original brief, he makes the following passage regarding public policy. And he says, quote, the purpose of the statute...
Well, if I might interrupt you here, let me just ask you about, I'm trying to understand what's in the preliminary injunction in this case versus the preliminary injunction. Is your understanding of the permanent injunction order here one that would preclude our proper pursuing arbitration under the 2011 agreement?
Arbitration?
Yes.
Your Honor, I'm not involved in those issues. Those issues are between. So I'm not the proper party to respond to that. But he recognizes the public policy of the statute that manufacturers should not be required to go investigate every patent if they're being furnished to specs. Yet he wants to extend it for owners for a burden on us. He now wants us to go police every use of our product to make sure it's not being installed or used in an infringing manner. That is not only impossible, it's absurd. Before I conclude, I would like to read a passage from RFR's present trial testimony, which is on page 36. That's under questioning from me. Question, and how does Rexxi commit the patent infringement? Your answer, you're manufacturing a product, or you manufactured a product that went into a system that it had to be installed in such a way. Question, what did Rexxi have to do with the installation of this product whatsoever? Answer, Rexxi didn't have anything to do with installation. Rexxi had everything to do with the manufacturing of the part that went into the system that required it to be installed in a certain way. Whether he wants to call it direct infringement or infringement, he is only suing us for manufacturing the part. All we did is exactly what Century told us to do. This is certainly a case that's entitled to both statutory and contractual indemnity.
Is there ongoing? Is your activity ongoing?
No, my understanding, this part is obsolete and it's no longer being manufactured by either parties. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Emerson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I represent Century Steps in this case. I've represented them for the last 9 years in this matter. It's all really the same matter that arises out of the initial lawsuit against my client, Century, back in 1998.
So are you in a position to answer my
question? Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. The permanent injunction does enjoin RFR from pursuing its arbitration claims related to the settlement agreement. And it,
in
court,
other words, let's assume hypothetically Century never pays any money that is arguably required in the settlement agreement.
That's right.
How is RFR supposed to have that issue adjudicated?
Unless you have it adjudicated in the same court that is determining the rights and the responsibilities of the parties under the settlement agreement, and that was the district court in front of Judge Kincaid.
Are you saying it's a contempt matter, not like a new case?
Well, it should have been brought in this case. It should have been brought in the Rexxi case below, the one that we are dealing
with. I thought the settlement provided for arbitration. If
they waived arbitration.
Violation of the settlement agreement.
Well, they waived arbitration in a number of ways. First of all, with regard to the sales of the filler that we have withheld payment for. For those, they filed the arbitration, and then they filed two separate lawsuits in federal court. First, a separate patent infringement lawsuit that we'll talk about in the next argument that claims that because we didn't pay for it, our consequent or subsequent sales of those products constituted infringement. So that's saying that's an infringement claim.
I still don't understand your response. It seems to me the basic circumstances are two parties have a lawsuit, the two parties settled the lawsuit, the settlement agreement provided for arbitration if they had a dispute about whether one or the other was not carrying out their obligations under the settlement agreement. If all that is correct, what authority does a district judge have to override that and say, no, no, you can't arbitrate, you only can file suits with me if there's a charge that the settlement agreement is not being complied with on one side or the other?
Yes, Your Honor. Under Fifth Circuit law, if a party substantially invokes the litigation process on an arbitral claim, then they waive the right to later arbitrate that claim. And in this case, they asked the court to determine the rights and responsibilities of the parties under the settlement agreement, specifically their duty to indemnify us. And the settlement agreement is like any other contract. We're going to pay you money.
It doesn't sound like the same issue. Of course, the law is clear that you can't litigate issue X this year and then next year, having lost in court, go to arbitration on issue X, but it looks to me like here it's not issue X, it's issue Y.
These issues are two sides of the same coin, Your Honor. This settlement agreement, we paid money for two things. One, a release. Two, indemnity in case we get sued. They litigated the issue of indemnity in the court before Judge Kincaid. And then wished to litigate the issue of payment under the settlement agreement. We're paying for an indemnity. They're saying they don't have to indemnify.
Yeah, but let's assume hypothetically that we were to agree with the district court that there is an obligation of RFR to indemnify you all.
Right.
So you've gotten your right of bargain. And let's assume hypothetically, and I don't know what the facts are, I'm not sure I want to know, that you have never paid, Century has never paid any money to RFR arguably owed under the settlement. So are you saying because you prevailed on the indemnity, you still don't have to pay anything under the settlement agreement? And that there's no way to arbitrate that or to litigate that issue?
We're saying it should have been brought in the district court,
not that they waived their right?
No, they haven't waived their right. No.
So what are you saying? The permanent injunction requires correctly that if they want to file a case tomorrow, they can file it, but the only case they can file is in judgment. In this particular court?
Yes, Your
Honor. And yes. What is the authority for, not when a case is pending, but this case is, let's say it's over now, in the Met, what is the authority for a district court to require that all parties come to that precise court after he no longer has any case pending before him?
Well, in this case, I believe it's just a matter of judicial efficiency. They're spreading these lawsuits out all over.
The question is authority. Even if it is efficient, if the judge doesn't have the authority to do it, he shouldn't do it. So the question is, where is his authority for all future time to order that disputes come to him as opposed to go to arbitrators or anywhere else?
Well, during the pendency of the case, of course, the judge has...
That is a permanent injunction, not a preliminary injunction.
I understand, but courts issue permanent injunctions all the time that enjoin future conduct. He's just saying that if you're going to go out and litigate this agreement,
we understand what it says. The question is, what is the source of authority for a district judge to order parties to come to him and not go to arbitrators or go to other parties?
I would just refer you back to the brief where there were cases that where parties have been serial lawsuit filers, such as in this case, and when parties have been required to file future lawsuits in front of a certain court. And that's the best I can do right now, and I'd be glad to submit a supplemental brief on that if you'd like.
This isn't a case where he's in some other court and Judge Kincaid is saying, no, these things should all be consolidated with me in Dallas. This is a case where he says he has a right in the future to go to arbitration, but the injunction, as I understand it, blocks him from going to arbitration.
Well, those are two different parts of the injunction. There's an injunction that says you have waived, there's a finding that he has waived arbitration by substantially invoking the litigation process, okay? Which means you're enjoined from pursuing the arbitration. The other part is, you've been filing these actions all over the place. In the future, if you have more of these, you need to come see me.
What if there's a state law? The parties here are both in Texas.
No, they're not. Your Honor, my client is in Louisiana. If I could discuss briefly our right to be indemnified by RFR under the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement is clear in Section 8.3 that RFR has to indemnify Century against any claims that Rex High or any other supplier might bring against us as a result of an RFR claim against that supplier. And that's exactly what happened in the case. RFR sued Rex High, Rex High sued us. We were entitled to indemnity from RFR against that claim. To hold otherwise would simply lead to an absurd result. If RFR is not responsible to us, to indemnify us, if they were to prevail on a patent infringement claim against Rex High, even if they were entitled to a set-off based on our prior settlement back in 2000, let's say we settled for $1 million and the court found there were $2 million in patent infringement damages. If there's no duty to indemnify on our forest park, then we're paying twice for the same claims, for the same infringement that we've already been released from. So I think to take that position is absurd. It would lead to absurd results.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So Oates will restore 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
May it please the court. If I could pick up with the last issue you talked about, it would not lead to an absurd result because under the one satisfaction rule, a party need only pay once for its damages. The no release clause should be found effective by this court for the primary reason that under Texas law, the recognized legal principle under which security of indemnity leads to extinguishment of claims is through the concept of release. And it is conclusively presumed that the parties contracted in reference to this legal principle. And this law constitutes an integral part of the agreement, as if it was incorporated therein. Therefore, this clause, the no release of Rexite clause, in these circumstances should be effectively interpreted to mean the indemnity agreement shall not be construed to release Rexite through security of indemnity.
Well, if that's what you wanted, why wasn't that what you wrote into the language?
Well, because there is danger in specificity. For example, if I would have thought that there was a danger of contractual indemnity, if I thought that the quote form and said result in contractual indemnity, and having thought of statutory indemnity, then they could say statutory indemnity was outside. If I had limited it to just this specific terms, then the lawyers may have come up with another type of agreement to get around the clause. So the best way to protect RFR was it had to go through the gateway of the principle of release. Therefore, the most effective and prudent and cautious thing to do was to put nothing shall be construed as a release of Rexite.
All right. Thank you very much. The next to your argument in the field number 05.